presentation. I'm going to sit down
and talk. And I'll try to maybe during the QA stand up so you guys can hear me a little better. I hope you can all see the images. They're much better and sharper on the computer. But because of the lighting, you can see a little bit. Does everybody here know who these images are on the screen? I think there's only two or three of you that know, right? Oh, you know?
Did you say anybody doesn't know or no?
I said there's probably two or three of you that seem to know, right?
Some of them are recognizable.
Okay, so who's the person on the far left? Up. Okay, what's his real name? Okay, good. Okay, and who's below him? Who's that? Alright, we just know the name, but okay. He'll be one of the subjects we discuss tonight. And then who is to the right of Fethullah Gulen?
The current prime minister.
Everyone knows that. And then the one that most people probably don't know, who's above? Okay, what's his name?
Said Nursi.
Yeah, that's kind of like his nickname. Yeah.
So who is he? Who was he?
Okay. Well, you have to stick around. You'll find out.
I was going to leave.
If you leave, you won't find out. Okay. So what I'm going to do is give you the context. Tonight's talk is entitled "Religion and Politics in Turkey: The Rise of the AKP Party." Oh, I should say the AK party and the Gulen movement, all right? But to understand these two phenomena, you have to understand the history of the late Ottoman Empire and then the development of the modern Republic of Turkey in the 1920s. Without understanding those two things, it's very difficult to understand how, you know, we got here. And that's true really with anything, right? You know that generally. You can't really understand, you know, American society today without, you know, the development of U.S. Constitution, without the Civil War. You know, why is the South so militaristic? Why do they hate Obama? Well, part of it is the fact that many of them are from the South, right? Things like that. So just like that here, you need to understand late, you know, Ottoman history as well as the Turkish Republic. And that's why I put these principles, figures, because by the last, within the 100 years of the formation of the modern state of Turkey, historians will look back and consider probably these four people to be four of the most, you know, significant players in modern Turkey. So with that, let's begin. I'm going to begin with the rise of European intervention in the Muslim world. Because that has what really caused a reevaluation of the role of Islam in the Muslim world and the role of Islam in Europe and North America. And as you can see, by the early 20th century, late 19th century, various colonial powers had pretty much, you know, taken over, politically speaking, but also in some place structurally, institutionally. All right. What did they do? They overthrew native dynasties. They, more importantly for our purposes, dismantled traditional systems of education and really promoted centralized authoritarian rule. So my family is from India, particularly from Hyderabad. And when I was growing up, and even today, people really, you know, made a big deal about the Nizam and the Nizam dynasty, right? Which is the princely state in central India of Hyderabad. And people would reminisce about this princely state as if it was a great thing. It was a positive thing. People would say things like, oh, the Nizam is the richest man in the world. Oh, and the Nizam is this, you know, and so forth. And if you're connected to the Nizam, you were a big deal back in those days. But when you look in history, you discover that the Nizam was really, unfortunately, a tool of the British Empire. And in fact, the Nizams played a central role in defeating one of the last remaining southern princely states in southern part of India. And as a result, it's something that we should sort of reevaluate and consider. Was this something that was important to have an authoritarian rule in the Muslim world, right? So this leads us then to really the first major rebellions against colonialism. And I highlighted India because it's personal for me. I'm from India, you know, I have Indian background. But I think it's also important for us to look at how the Muslim community dealt with the reaction. So in 1857, by this time in India, the British Empire, through the use of an economic entity called the British East Indian Tea Company, had pretty much developed a stranglehold, economic and political, over India. And by the mid-19th century, while the descendants of the Mughal Empire existed in Delhi, they were pretty much, you know, without any serious power. And in 1857, a rebellion broke within the ranks of the Sepoy army. The Sepoy are the natives that were, you know, chosen by the British to sort of govern them, just like the United States propped up the Iraqi army or the Afghan local army. The British did the same thing with the local Hindus and Muslims. Well, these people revolted for various reasons, which I don't want to get to. And as a result, they took over Delhi for a very short period of time, like 4 months. And they promoted the last remaining descendant of the Mughal, Bahadur Shah, as the new head of state. Well, the British then engaged in a massive crackdown. I would say, comparatively speaking, it was similar to the crackdown that the U.S. had against Muslims after September 11th. Maybe not as bad, but the one that the British did was even worse. Why? Because that crackdown led to the assassination, not assassination, execution of the remaining family members of the Mughal dynasty, except for the Bahadur Shah and a couple of young sons, which were like in their early, maybe 6-7 years old. And then it also left the power base of the Muslim community in Delhi completely dismantled. And as a result, Muslims lost power, lost money, and positions in Delhi, which was the capital of the Muslims of India for several centuries. All right. Let's see some images. Here's some images from the rebellion of hangings and things like that. Okay. So, after, in fact, Muslims were barred from the capital of Delhi. The ulama, many of them were executed because they were considered to be in cahoots with the rebels and so forth. So as a result, and I'm sticking strictly to the religious dimension here, the religious community, meaning the ulama and the religious class in the Muslim Indian context, then engaged in a reaction to what the British did. Okay, and I've outlined three different reactions. And this is important because we think that when we think of religious actors like the ulama or the religious actors in Muslim, they all think the same, they all act the same, they all behave the same way. But as you can see, there are three separate reactions. One was what I labeled accommodation. And this was the view of Sayyid Ahmed Khan, who many of you know as Sir Sayyid, which he believed that, you know, it was important for the Muslims of India to work with the British and to learn from the British, particularly in the areas of science and education. And as a result, he began, with the help of the British, a important college, which ultimately came to be known as Aligarh University in UP. A second reaction was the one that most people are aware of, which is jihad, or a physical confrontation against the British to push them out. And that was led by another scholar named Sayyid Ahmed Shahid. He was ultimately killed in Afghanistan. And then finally, there's a third reaction. And this one is probably one you're very familiar with, because many of the adherents of this particular school of thought actually live in Chicago, like Maulana Saleem, for example, who's from Deoband. His father was a professor of hadith in Deoband. And the Deobandis believe, well, we can't fight the British. We're not going to, you know, adopt their way of thinking into our way of thinking. Instead, because of the attacks against the religious institutions, the closing of madrasas, and the killing of ulama, we're simply going to preserve the tradition. We want to make sure that Arabic, Hadith, and Quran are preserved. So they moved about 70 miles northeast into a small little village called Deoband and instituted the development of a school called the Darul Ulum. All right? So this to give you an idea is that people in different circumstances react differently, even if they're within the same social class. In this case, the religious class. All right? So the reason this is also important because you always hear people say things like, well, you know, the ulama are backward, they all think the same, etc. Sayyid Ahmad Khan was from a religious family. His father and grandfather were all religious scholars. Okay. So let's go now to the Ottoman Empire, which, as you know, lasted for like six centuries, a long time. And it was a empire that was based politically on a family dynasty. A family dynasty with its capital in Constantinople eventually. It was considered, according to the Ottomans anyway, as the sort of leader of the Islamic Empire religiously and politically in many ways. And they existed at their height of power in three major continents. Europe, and the fact that I have Europe listed first is not an accident. The Ottoman Empire, the founding of the Ottoman Empire, was rooted initially in Europe, in the Balkans. Okay. Later on, they sort of began to conquer territories in what's today Anatolia or Turkey. And then, of course, later on the Middle East. Okay. So they had their first hold in Europe, and they always consider themselves European. All right. So when we get to the 20th century... You have various ideological, philosophical, political, religious responses to European colonialism. All right, and I've sort of provided some of these. From the religious perspective, outside of the Indian sphere, of course, you had, you know, different ideas. One was the notion that, oh, forget Europe, forget modernity. Let's just do whatever the Prophet did, and let's just do whatever the Sahaba did. Okay, and that's sometimes known as Salafism. Now, these terms, Salafism, which is used by Salafis themselves and also academics, is a very broad term. It could be used to describe various perspectives. Okay, then another view is religious revivalism, meaning that the only way to truly live your life as a complete Muslim is the development and establishment of what's called an Islamic state. Okay. And then finally, modernism is something that I alluded to earlier with Sayyid Ahmad Khan. But Muslims did not rely on religious principles alone in order to sort of deal with European domination. They also looked at European ideology. So a lot of Muslims, religious or otherwise, adopted secularism. And you see this in the case of the Turkish example. You see it in the case of also other forms of European ideas like nationalism, right? Nationalism, whether it's Egyptian nationalism, the notion of Pakistan, the notion of Turkey, right? The notion of being an Iraqi or a Somali, whatever. Nationalism comes into the Muslim world and it's adopted by various actors. And finally, other ideologies such as socialism, Marxism, which are promoted by various Muslim thinkers. And I just mentioned one, which is Ali Shariati out of Iran, that many of you know. Okay. So in other words, Muslims, having been sort of conquered by various European states, are trying to figure out how can we maintain our past and also then survive in the present. And I'm just giving you some examples here of what is viewed as the sort of traditional Islamic revival movements, the ones that are promoting the Islamic state. And as you can see, I've provided three. One in the Arab context, which is the Ikhwan al-Muslimin. And the other is the South Asian context, which is the Jamaat Islamiyah, led initially by Maududi. And then finally, in the Iranian context, which was Ayatollah Khomeini, who believed that the only way to preserve your Islamic tradition was to develop an Islamic state based upon a government of the scholars, or the Vilayat al-Faqih, governance of the Faqih, the lawyers, so forth. Okay? So these are answers, proposals to how to deal with the influence of European and later American ideas, thoughts into the Muslim world. Right? Okay. So this is going on, you know, in the 20th century, early to late 20th century. Right? So we got that, right? That's the context. Now with that, let's go to Turkey. Okay, Turkey is formed officially after all kinds of issues, particularly, I mean, the Ottoman Empire ends because of World War I, when Turkey, the Ottoman Empire sides with what's known as the Axis powers and loses. The Ottoman Empire was the biggest loser of World War I. Okay? Biggest loser. Not only in terms of losses of massive territories, particularly territories in what's called the Middle East, as well as various European sectors, but also in terms of pure human life. Close to 25% of the Ottoman Empire lost its population. 25%, the highest of any single nation, Britain, France, the United States, Germany, etc. So anyway, as a result of that, there's a lot of upheavals, rebellions, etc. Ultimately, in the 1920s, the Turkish Republic of Turkey is formed, led by the person who sort of saved Turkey from complete collapse. And that's, of course, Mustafa Kemal, who's known as the father of the Turks, Atatürk. Because he was able to at least preserve what remained of the Ottoman Empire, he became an instant hero and supported. However, what he promoted was what we call a sort of secular nationalism, the promotion of Turkish identity at a core principle of this new country, and also the elimination of religion from the public square. Okay? There's a picture of him on horseback in his military uniform. So this is before the establishment of the Turkish state, and this is after. As you can see, he has donned the European wardrobe. He has dropped the fez, the traditional wardrobe, and put on his coat, tuxedo, etc. His wife used to wear hijab, and then in the photos that you see in the late 20s, she's no longer wearing hijab, she's wearing European wardrobe, etc. So, after Atatürk takes over, what does he do? He abolishes the caliphate. He closes down religious institutions and religious networks, namely the Taruk, or the Sufi Tariqas. And incredibly, not only abandons the Arabic Turkish script, but Latinizes it, right? Latinizes the script. And of course, forces people to change their wardrobe from the traditional outfits to more European outfits. And imposed women to be better educated and also to participate in the workforce. Now this was, what's important to understand is this is all coming from the top down, okay, from the upper government, right? Okay, what do we call this? This process where religion is eliminated from the public square and is completely at the behest of the state. Secular nationalism is promoted. We call this either Kemalism or Laicism. Laicism specifically means the establishment of the control of religion by the state. Okay? This is the opposite of the American system. Okay? In the American system, the state is there to make sure that it doesn't intervene in the lives of religion. Okay? And there's sort of a balancing act that you look and interpreting the U.S. Constitution. Whereas in Laicism, it's complete domination of the state over religion, whether it's institutions, people, but also ideas. In the Turkish model, is a very right-wing approach, which is even the sermons that the Muslim khatibs did were provided by the state. Very, you know, very kind of top-down approach. The other ideas included promotion of science, over religion. So science became the sort of end-all of all knowledge. And as I mentioned, religious networks like Sufi tariqas and others were closed. And of course, the promotion of something called a Turkish identity and everybody rallying around a Turkish identity. All right. So now, let's go with the development then of Turkish politics. So when Ataturk and the people around him begin to form this new country in the 20s, it was based upon a political party, a group of him and his followers, called the Republican People's Party. And that party basically dominated Turkey from the mid-1920s all the way to the mid-40s. All right? And that's what's known as the single party rule. Right? And this party, the Republican People's Party, is then challenged in the mid-1940s by other actors, other people who want to get involved more and promote more kind of activity so that it opens up to other players. And ultimately, they're successful. And a new party comes in and actually defeats Ataturk's party in 1950 elections, and they're called the Democratic Party. And that's the first time in Turkish history. So it's like a 25-year change. So for 25 years, this very secular, hardcore national military party controls Turkey. And then in the 50s, it's led by Adnan Menderes. Now, what he does is interesting. Adnan Menderes is largely responsible for Turkey being part of NATO, opening up some economic opportunities, but also loosening up some of the control of the state over religious institutions. So prior to 1947, for example, the government had banned the public announcement of the azan. So the azan was not heard. Okay. Adnan Menderes comes in and he cancels that law. Okay. So they did a lot of this, but he really engaged in a lot of heavy-handed politics. So ultimately, he's challenged and he is overtaken in a military coup after 10 years of power in 1960. He's actually hanged by a military junta in 1961. But the important thing is that it's Menderes who begins the process of loosening the reins of control from the top. Why is that important? Because it allows for the flexibility and the freedom of various political actors, which later on become religiously minded actors like the AKP, as well as the development of religious networks. Okay, this is just a quick list of the military coups that occurred. All right, we're going to jump ahead about 20 years to what's known, the era known as the Third Republic. Why? Because in the Third Republic, you have this gentleman, who is Turgut Özal, who, through his party called the Motherland Party, is able to establish a coalition and governs. Turgut Özal is very important both for the Gulen movement today and the AK party, because what he does is he once again promotes the loosening up of state control over religious institutions, promotes private education. Remember, when the Ataturk took over in the 20s, education, secular education, was also completely state-controlled. There are no private universities until Turgut Özal comes into power in the 80s. He promotes, you know, private, secular education, so private schools can develop and form their own. And this allows then religious actors to develop private schools and so forth. Okay, promotes more women in school, tries to take people from these large rural areas into a more urban dynamic so they can be involved in what's going on globally, and opens up Turkish markets so that they can produce goods and export them to Europe. That's very important for the development of GDP for Turkey in the 90s and 2000s. Okay. So, Menderes and now Özal. Okay. Finally, as a result of these activities, this door that's opened initially in the 60s and then finally in the 80s opens up the opportunity for people who have a Islamic bent, politically speaking, to form their own parties. So we have, for example, a guy by the name of Nejmuddin Erbakan, who some of you are probably familiar with, who is not a new player, was actually voted into parliament in the late 60s, forms his party called Welfare Party, or the Rafa Party, and in a very surprise move, joins a coalition with the previous prime minister, Tanju Tiller, and then takes over, and it becomes like the first Islamist political party of Turkey. It lasts for about a year until he's then overthrown by the military. And not only is he overthrown, but his party is ultimately banned by the courts, and Erbakan himself is banned from political politics for about 5 years thereafter. This then leads to various weak governments or coalitions that formed after the Rafa Party from the late 90s up until 2002, when, as a result of more economic opportunities, the rise and the growth of a younger population, the promotion of education for men and women, and the development of private schools, you have a new generation of political leaders who were affiliated with the Rafa Party of Nejmuddin Erbakan, but who thought that his move into Turkish society, which has a strong Islamic tenor, would not be good for that party. So they abandoned Nejmuddin and formed their own party. And this party is known, of course, as the Adalet ve Kalkima, or the Justice and Development Party. That's what AK stands for, Justice and Development, Adalet, from the Arabic term Adal. All right, what's interesting is that the acronym of this party, AK, also is referred to in Turkish as pure or white, uncorruptible. Okay, and you'll see why that's an irony today. Okay, what's important about this party, besides the historical dimension, is that they strongly believed in, and this was the leader, Erdogan, who was a former mayor of Istanbul, believed in a strong economic liberalism, hugely promoted entrepreneurship all across the board. Also believed in a social conservatism, strong moralities. Women with hijab should be able to work in the public force, employment force, but also in, should be able to work and teach at universities. Believed in a strong constitution, complete, very anti-military, and more importantly, strong foreign policy based upon a close relationship with the European Union, and ultimately applies for entry into the European Union. There's Erdogan. And then, now he's the prime minister, so the president is Abdullah Gül, which is, his role is largely ceremonial. He's one of the leaders of the within the AK party. But he's the one who will go to various venues and appear on behalf of Turkey, etc. He doesn't necessarily make decisions in terms of policy. But he's still an important, at least, symbolic figure for both Turkey and AK. All right. So that takes us through the sort of political vision or picture of Turkey. And as you can see here, I found this picture very interesting because to me it represents the step-by-step development of the political characters and genealogy from Menderes to Özil, finally to this guy. Okay. Any questions so far on the politics? Because next I'm going to go into the religion.
Well, it's quite interesting. Carry on.
Okay. All right, let's...
Could I ask you one question? You referred to NATO membership of Turkey and also obviously the European Union potential entry.
Yeah.
You what is the status of Turkey in NATO organization? Is it a full-fledged member? And secondly, what is the, in your opinion, chances of Turkey joining the European Union?
Well, the first answer, first question, yes, they're a full-fledged member. Absolutely. So, for example, if Turkey is ever, say, militarily attacked by the Soviet Union, then it is a absolute requirement for the other NATO members to come to the defense of Turkey. Okay. They're also engaged in military sharing, training, exercises with other NATO powers, and so forth. Okay. Now, with respect to the European Union, I think at this point, I think there are very, very few people that are hopeful that Turkey will join the European Union. And that's not because of Turkey. It's because Europe is just anti-Muslim. And that's the prevailing view as to why, which is ironic because Turkey became one of the most secular countries, generally speaking. And still, that wasn't good enough for the Europeans. So, okay. All right, let's go into religion. Again, you know, you have to sort of understand the history of the Ottoman Empire to understand the rise or the role of religious actors in the 20th and 21st century. But one thing that's important is that Sufism was a very important feature of Ottoman history, both from the origins of the Ottoman Empire, beginning with Osman Gazi, who, you know, had various important confidants who were Sufi sheikhs, and throughout the entire reign of the Ottoman Empire. And in particular, various Sufi orders would be beholden to or close with the various sultans. But one of the ones that played a very important role, it's interesting because the Naqshbandi order that I'm talking about now is not only important in the Ottoman Empire, but it's also important in India, as I highlight here, and Central Asia. Now, the Naqshbandis were important because and they were able to spread very quickly is because their ability to sort of reform certain methods and practices much quickly than others, like the Chishtiyya, for example, or the Qadariyya. And also, one of the most important scholars within the Naqshbandi tradition, Ahmed Sirhindi, was a very important religious scholar of general report, considered one of the most important of the century. And he's often labeled as the Mujaddid, or the renewer of faith, along the same levels as Ibn Taymiyyah and Al-Ghazali, etc. His student then takes his teachings and goes to the Ottoman Empire and promotes it and starts other circles of Naqshbandi teachings. So the Naqshbandis become very influential amongst religious circles in the late Ottoman Empire and ultimately in early 20th century Turkey. Why is that important? It's important because this man, Said Nursi, many of his teaching circles were within the Naqshbandi movement. Now, before I get that, I just want you to sort of look at a definition of social movement. This is a definition of a social movement by a very famous sociologist, Italian sociologist, named Malucci. And what he defines as a social movement is that a social movement is a group or clusters of people who form an active resistance to the state and seek to free people from state domination so that people can utilize their human potential and assert collective identity. And this is a general definition. This is important. Why? To me, this definition, which is applicable to any political, social environment, religious or otherwise, and also not just necessarily in Turkey, but it could apply here in the United States, Turkey, elsewhere, in China. To me, it really demonstrates the tension that you see today between the Gulen movement and the AK party, which is the notion that the government, every strong government, seeks to try to control others. It seeks to control its population. It seeks to control the business community. It seeks to control the religious community and elsewhere. Okay? And whenever you have a countervailing force, a countervailing group of people who resist, whether actively or quietly, it poses a challenge to the state. Okay? So from that definition, let's think now as we move ahead and talk about two now important movements in Turkey. First is led by a guy by the name of Said Nursi, whose nickname is Bediüzzaman, or the light, you know, the light of time or the light of our contemporary period. He was an ethnic Kurd, so you can see he straddles the end of the Ottoman Empire to the rise of modern Turkey. And he became a traditional alim. His brother was a very important influence in his life, who trained him in many instances. And he lived a very pivotal period. He participated in World War I. He participated in all kinds of political activities. Ultimately, he was jailed. He was exiled, etc. And he was very heavily influenced by Tasawwuf. Okay? Very heavily influenced by Tasawwuf. But what made him different from a traditional Naqshbandi is that he did not necessarily follow a particular tariqa, and also departed from them in terms of their focus on exclusively developing the nafs, or purifying the nafs. Okay? So, what are his principles? Very fascinating person. So I've broken down into three areas: education, politics, and government. So in religion, this is what makes him unique, I think. Remember, he's living in the rise of European colonization, the development of the power of European science, military ideas, right? And the decline of the Muslim world. So for him, religion and Islam are important in the modern period. Why is that important? Why is that obvious to him? I mean, why is that, it sounds obvious to us, but why is that important for him? Because of Kemalism. Because of the development of the elimination of religion, and particularly Islam, in the Turkish social and civic life. He departs, as I mentioned earlier, from traditional tasawwuf by saying, we're not only going to focus on cultivating our inner self that we, as Muslims, normally do through prayer, through dhikr, through fasting, but also he believed that reason and faith can be reconciled, and that reason and science was important for Muslim societies today. And of course, his emphasis on textual study of the sacred sources, in particular the Quran, was very important. But he didn't simply rely on old interpretations or literal interpretations that Muslims had followed, but rather wanted to read the Quran in light of what was going on in his contemporary life. Okay. And what's important also with Said Nursi, and you see this with the Gulen movement, is the fact that to them, having political power, whether you are a Muslim or not, at the top, is not the most important thing. But rather, developing individuals who are faith-based, who are moral, who believe in justice and commitments and principles, that is much more important for society than simply having people at the top who call themselves Muslims. Okay? That's the difference between someone like Said Nursi and other what we call Islamist parties like the AK. Okay, what about government? What was his view on government? He was against Kemalism, as I alluded to earlier, but he also believes that democracy is the best form of government. That's important, because here you have an Islamic scholar saying this. So how many times have we heard khutbahs in our own community living in the United States, in Chicago, in the past 30 years? How many times have we heard khatibs rail against democracy, right? Condemn democracy as un-Islamic or this and that. Here you have a person living in the Muslim world, a traditional scholar, saying that democratic political principles are essential for the Muslim world at that time. Okay? And importantly, and this is kind of in line with his religious views, which is that religion is not to be promoted at the state level, okay, and used for its own particular agenda. Okay, he was against Islamic political parties, okay, and importantly, he believed that the government serves the needs of the people and should not force people to believe. So, in a sense, you know, he has some Republican views. Let's put it that way. Okay? He doesn't want the government involved in the lives, daily lives of people. Okay? Very interesting, right? Finally, education. The purpose of education is to develop collective piety so that people are close to God, but also that they're understanding what's going around them. They're not clueless, okay? They know what's going on. They know what science is. They know what biology is. They know what chemistry is, okay? Etc. In order to achieve this, what he and then his followers after his demise did was to promote what are called textual communities, or they're sometimes known as darsanas, which are study circles. People sitting together, just like this, for example, meeting once a week in a social gathering, but instead of simply listening to a boring lecture like me, or lecturer like me, opening up your text and reading the text together, reading and interpreting the text together. Okay? And what does that do? It brings not only a sense of a social cohesiveness, but it also provides a relationship developed with the Word of God, okay? A furtherment of understanding of the Word of God, and allows you to think for yourself with the text, as opposed to simply listening to a lecture for 40 minutes about what the text says, which is generally our approach in the Muslim community, particularly here. You listen to some alim for 40 minutes telling you what the text means, and you're just kind of sitting there. Now, I'm being a little, you know, cynical, but that's how I feel anyway. But I'm sure other people have much better ideas about that than I do. Okay, so those are the ideas of Sayyid Nursi. These ideas of Sayyid Nursi are so profound, so interesting, so powerful, that various people begin to promote these ideas, and various circles, groups form around the reading of these texts. Not only were these groups meeting to read the Quran, but most of them met to read the works of Sayyid Nursi. And his most important work is called the Risala al-Nur. Okay? Risala al-Nur. And these are the English translations that you can find. Very interesting. If you read the first works called The Words, for example, you can find, it's like a thick volume in English, you can find those. If you read them, and they're basically stories. Stories of people dealing with, you know, tensions in the world, in life, particularly around science and faith, okay? Being true to one's word, you know, basic core values and principles. They're kind of interesting. I came across this, I think, at an ISNA convention once. There was a table set by some followers of Sayyid Nursi, and I had no idea who he was. So I said, hey, who are you people? And they said, oh, have you ever heard of Sayyid Nursi? I said, never heard of Sayyid Nursi. And they go, well, this is his book called The Words. Here, you can have it for free. I said, oh, thank you. So I read, I said, wow, that was kind of interesting. And that must have been like 1997, 1998. All right. So there are many, then, subsequent groups that follow the teachings of Sayyid Nursi. Okay? The one that is known most throughout the world, and the one that became the most popular, is what's known as the Gulen movement. Okay? Now, the Gulen movement refers to, of course, Fethullah Gulen, that's his name, the scholar Fethullah Gulen. And in amongst this movement, they call themselves the Hizmet movement. The Hizmet movement, which means service in Turkish. Turkish people outside of Hizmet call them the Jamaat. Okay? The Jamaat, meaning the gathering. Okay? And a very small, simple definition of the Gulen movement is that it's a transnational movement inspired by the teachings of scholar and theologian Fethullah Gulen. By the way, does anybody know where Fethullah Gulen lives now? Pennsylvania. He lives in this mountainous area called the Poconos. Now, if you look at him, he looks like a simple guy. In fact, if you look at him, you wouldn't even think he's like a scholar. Why? Because he doesn't have a beard, right? And of course, in Islamic, to show you the state of education in Islam, we equate knowledge with facial hair. Okay? And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. So, let's talk about who this person is. Fethullah Gulen believes in these principles of education, service, believes in business, media, and interfaith dialogue. I first heard of him in 2004 when I was invited to present a paper on interfaith dialogue in Turkey. And I had no idea who this guy was, and I went to Turkey and made a presentation at in Istanbul. And that's when I first heard about it because his pictures were all over and a lot of his followers were around. And that's when I sort of learned about who he was and then got to know the movement and also visited Turkey and visited various institutions that they have. So in terms of his biographical information, he's born 1941, was from Eastern Turkey, comes from a religious family, meaning his father was an imam, his mother taught Quran. And again, all these guys, and much like the rest of the Muslim world before the 20th century, almost all scholars came from some Sufi background. I would say something like 95% of Islamic scholars, probably until the 1950s, 1940s, all had some connection to teachings of tasawwuf. Okay? And of course, he as a teenager came across and learned of the teachings of Said Nursi and then participated in the dersanes, the study circles that I mentioned earlier. But what makes Fethullah Gulen so interesting is that he took the teachings of Said Nursi and institutionalized them. So Said Nursi, in a sense, is the sort of, you know, person who develops the ideas and template. And then Fethullah Gulen takes those ideas and institutionalizes them and brings them on the ground in a much more, I would say, I don't want, maybe aggressive is not the right term, but I would say much more elaborate, aggressive way. Okay. So as Said Nursi, he believes that personal transformation through education is absolutely important. So education is not something which is simply learning and memorizing, okay? But education involves transforming your soul and yourself into a different kind of person, okay? And to do that, it's not enough to simply attend boring lectures, but rather they developed not just study circles, but went beyond to what he called lighthouses. These would be boarding houses that people would live in for years and be with like-minded groups and study. Then he went another step further, developing universities, okay, summer camps. In addition to writings, etc., he also gave weekly, and I think continues to give weekly lectures and sermons, which are heard all across the world. Okay. So these are the key core concepts of the Hizmet movement. Number one, that faith is essential in the modern world. That the West, and this I think is very, very unique to this particular movement, which is that the West, whatever that means for now, and Islam are compatible. They're not incompatible. Okay, they're compatible. I think this is the reason, the main reason for this, because it's the legacy of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans, as strong proponents of Sunni Islam, did not consider themselves non-European. Okay? That's important. They considered themselves European. In fact, they considered themselves, when Mehmed II, Fatih, conquered Constantinople, he referred to himself as the emperor of the new successor to the Roman Empire. Okay. Education, and but not just education, like just religious education, just learn Hadith, Quran, and Arabic, and you're done. But all education, secular education, but more importantly, excellence in education. So when you visit Turkey, you not only see, you know, mosques and masajid and so forth, and not only good food, but you find people who are at the upper echelon of education, people with PhDs at every level, the use of technology at every level, all across the board, women, men, different ethnic groups, different backgrounds, all across the board. a huge promotion of economic development. Why? Because without money, you can't run institutions. Institutions, no matter how good the leader is, no matter how good the ideas are, without money, they fritter away and die. So one of the clever things that he did was to go to business people and say, hey, look, we got these institutions, we got these educational facilities, we got these, we need you as part of your faith to give donation. But when you develop entrepreneurship, don't do it for the sake of driving nice cars and building big houses and living in big, nice, fancy houses in the suburbs. Rather, use that money to give and fund these institutions. Okay? And he was very successful at convincing the business class to do this. That was very another very unique aspect of him. Believes in interfaith dialogue. I remember 20 years ago, in fact, I was in law school, and I was living in Tulsa, and I remember having to argue with the leadership there, and even here in this community, argue with leadership that interfaith dialogue is essential for the Muslim community. Right? And it was very difficult to get people to think, accept that. And here you have a Turkish scholar from overseas in the 80s saying, this is our platform, interreligious dialogue with Jews and Christians, different Christian groups, absolutely essential for the Muslim community. Right? That's what you call a visionary leader. That takes guts to do, right? In light of the situation, etc. Finally, Islam must be, has to be, a religion of peace. Cannot promote any kind of, you know, violence and terrorism, etc. Okay? Those are basically essential principles and concepts of the Hizmet movement. And I've sort of put pictures of some of their institutions. So, for example, they've got their leading newspaper called Zaman, which is in Turkish, and then Today Zaman, which is English. To the right, Zaman Yulu is their television station, which beams all across the world. The university, one of the most prominent private universities in all of Turkey, called Fatih University in Istanbul. And just if you look at that campus, it's really impressive. And then finally, the Writers and Journalists Foundation, which promotes interfaith dialogue, but also publishes writings of various kinds of activities, and also plans various kinds of events, including, you know, providing a space for women scholars, women activists to speak and write, etc. This is just a few of the institutions. They have banks and other things and so forth. So that's it. So I'll stop there and, you know, let you...
Quite an extensive and elaborate presentation.
Thank you. And I'm sure that you have